used to in school. He'd been at Worthing Grammar School then. And
how did he do that? What was his school performance like?
Well, he was ambivalent about it. He liked some of the teachers. He felt he knew more than some of the teachers, which was probably right. He wanted to get to a good university. He felt he was ready for a good university. So I spoke to Dennis Brogan at the Reform Club, we met, and I said, look, I had a son called Philip, and this time's going to go to the university. What do you think? And Brogan, who had been a Peterhouse during the war, as they were in the LSE moved out, said, place for him to go, his interest in history is Peterhouse. They've got more fellows than they've got students, which wasn't quite true, but it seemed like that. And it's the place for historians to go. Tell him to apply. Peterhouse. He interviewed and so on. Which Philip did, interviewed. They said, fine, you're in. And that was a great boost to him. Because he enjoyed Cambridge a great deal. He met new friends who he thought were his intellectual equal, which he hadn't had at work. People like, I think, Affleck, Thirlby, Cornford, you know, they were just as bright as Philip in their own way, sometimes a little misguided. One or two of them thought a little too highly of communism. But anyway, they were interesting. Yeah. And he would bring them along. By that time, we were living in the Balkans, I think. He would bring them along, and it was fine to have them there. Occasionally, he would ask if we would move out so that he could have a party there.
What was he like with Evelyn as well? She must have been, she was around at that time. She,
yeah, Evelyn was around at that time.
How much younger was she?
23 to 38, 5 years younger.
5 years younger. So the same gap, in fact, as myself and Rebecca.
That's right, yeah.
So how did they get on?
They got on pretty well. She liked him. He felt a sort of fatherly interest in her progress. It was a rather a strange fatherly interest in the sense that he was more inclined to deprecate and laugh at some of the things she thought were smart and good. But clearly, you know, they got on okay. But he, by the time he went to Cambridge, he was very much caught up with Cambridge life. You know, the few occasions in which I met people at Cambridge, like Poston, who was the professor of economic history there, they thought he was very good, very good. As I believe he was a historian, he was good. He then got a year's fellowship at Oxford, I think, didn't he? Went off to St. Anthony's, and he was one of the new colleges there. But he almost immediately went back to Peterhouse. And I remember him telling me two things at Peterhouse. When he reached the age of 25, he got a notice from the War Office saying, when you become 26, you will no longer be liable to be called up for military service. And therefore, will you report to the military tribunal next Monday or Tuesday, whenever it was. So Philip surely, turned up, and then said no, he was a conscientious objector. What? Yes. Against it. And they said on religious grounds. He said, oh no, no, not religious grounds. That didn't help them. If he had said on religious grounds, they would have said, oh, thank God, beat it. But no, he wasn't going to have it on those grounds. And they said, oh, well then, you'd rather do work of national importance of some kind. I don't think you'd be much good in the coal mines. Couldn't have known, I don't think you'd be much good in the coal mines. What else is there? By this time they were getting pretty fed up with him. And they said, oh, we can think of something for you to do. Why don't you go in the distributive trade and help in a shop? So Philip went and got a job with the Cambridge Co-op Society delivering milk. Two things. He apparently did his job well. The round delivery started at 6 a.m. in the morning. He was there on time always. But three things I remember from there. First of all, that he used to take on other people's rounds as well in the afternoon, so as to get more money. Always needed money, Philip. And the other thing was that he was going around one day with the milkman, and Butterfield, head of Peter House, saw him. He said, what are you doing there? Get down, get back to your duties. And Philip said, no, I'm on military service. Butterfield said, you clown. You're supposed to be working on lock. And Philip said, that's what I do in the afternoon. I work on John Locke and explain the situation to him. He fell off one morning, fell off his milk delivery van, and broke an ankle, a wrist. He was taken into Addenbrooke's and they set it. But they set it badly, so he had to go back, it was broken, and reset again. And then he got an honourable discharge from military duties.
At what point did he meet Sonia? This must have been fairly round about that time.
Or it was round about that time. He was already, you know, I think, I'm sure he was his assistant, because he spent his summer holidays usually with Jean and me in France. First of all in Provence, around Avignon, and then later on in Burgundy, he'd go away with us.
Which he became very attached to, didn't he, those areas? He used to take me there.
He loved it. Yeah. God. I've never seen anyone enjoy a holiday so much. Even when he was stopped by a French gendarme, who obviously thought this uppity adolescent loafing around Orange. No. And he came over and said in French to Philip, show me your papers. He said, of course. And he used his British passport and said, I'm a tourist. The gentleman said, motioned to him on, defeated. But he always enjoyed those holidays. He would say, you've got to get up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning because the only bus to wherever it is, Roussignon, goes at 7 from the city gates and we must be there. He was there ahead of us. And he would occasionally do some absolutely bumpy things. I don't know if he ever took you to on it, Pont du Gard, a great range viaduct across the mountains, the hills, which the Romans have built as a viaduct. He climbed all the way up the side of the hill, on top of the parapet of this thing, and began walking along it. It made me dizzy just to look at him. But we don't shout, or he wouldn't have heard us anyway. Yeah. And we thought, oh God, we better keep our eyes closed. Yeah. But he was enjoying it.
Mm.
He thought it was terrific. And also he was, on those holidays, there was always the historian there.
Mm.
You know, when we took him once to Villeneuve-les-Avignon, which is across the river from Avignon itself, it was great medieval fortresses, and it did. Now one can see the brutality and the violence side of feudalism. That great massive fortress there, you know, which was the quintessence of brutalism in architecture.
Mm.
And it was a great joy to be with him on holiday. Places like that. And then, you know, when we were in Burgundy the second time, in his third year, when he got a cable from his tutor saying a first. Very pleased. And the Monsieur Le Patron wanted to know, you know, was there any trouble, you know, a cable had never had a cable in that little village before. So, in such French as we could muster between the three of us, we explained to him. And that night, for dinner, he produced not only the usual food, but a special bottle of Courton Chardin, very finest Burgundy wine you could possibly get. And he said, Monsieur Le Victor, bring it in front of Philip.
Ah, sounds lovely.
Well, anyway, that was those years, and we first saw Sonia when we were in Cambridge to see him one afternoon after he'd graduated, and a young girl passed by on a bicycle, and she beamed at Philip. And Philip sort of looked a little embarrassed and, and walked on. And we didn't say anything. Obviously, he didn't want to say anything, so what can we do? And then when we were introduced to Sonia some time later, we recognized her as the girl on the bicycle. I remember him going, when he was at Cambridge, to see Butterfield and say that, sure, he was giving lectures or supervisions on British 17th century, 18th century political thought. What he would like to do would be to get round to the still surviving founding members of the British Labour Party and First British Labour Parliamentary Party, you know, after World War I, interview them, get down their accounts of how they've lived and happened, and bring together some archive material which they must have in their homes. Butterfield said, oh, you mean journalism you want to go into? And he said, no, history. Butterfield said, I would call it journalism, Philip.
Yeah.
So Philip gave up. He knew that you wouldn't be allowed to do that.
Mm. And what were you doing during that time? So we're coming up to more or less the time, well, presumably you must have married Sonia sort of sometime 1957.
Yeah, something like that. Oh, God, did we have a wrangle about that? Went on and on. Neither of them wanted to get married in a synagogue.
Mm.
But Morris was furious about this. God, how he carried on. His dear old dad would die if he heard the news, and they couldn't keep the news from him if anything like this happened to disgrace the family. Why didn't I talk to them? Why didn't I insist? I was the father of the bridegroom, and the bridegroom had the word, final word on this. I said, all right, I'll talk to Philip about it. Philip said, he doesn't see any point in it. They can go to a registry office, pay the fee, and be married. That seems to them the important thing. And they didn't think much of this lark of going off to a synagogue and stamping on a goblet under a canopy. And Sonia was just as insistent as well. And I said, well, look, you know, as far as you're concerned, you know that going to the synagogue thing doesn't really do any harm, any damage to your marriage, and you would have the bonus that it would give some pleasure to Morris's father. You know, and it won't cost you anything in terms of any sacrifice you have to make that means anything to you. Of course, you're going to get married in a registry office anyway. And he agreed. Morris was a bit of a bastard. I remember when they were getting married, just before they were getting married, and you know, the custom in Jewish families, particularly families which are so determined that weddings should take place in synagogues and so on, the custom is that the bride's father makes some contribution towards the cost of the reception and the meal and that sort of thing. You know. And clearly Morris had no intention of doing this, so it was arranged we should have him and Tilly round to dinner one evening, and I would bring up the subject. And this was at the Boltons,
yeah.
And they came round, and after they'd had a good meal, we moved into a comfortable front room. I put him in a nice armchair, and then I said, oh, Morris, by the way, something we ought to discuss, I suppose, and that is, you know, the allocation of the costs of this reception, these people being invited, and their holiday afterwards, and, you know, all that sort of thing. And I thought, you know, perhaps we should go 50-50 in this, thinking this was a great gesture on my part. And I said, 50-50? I wouldn't give them a penny. You want them to get married, you pay for it.
Oh, God.
And that finished the discussion.
Yeah.
I think Tilly was a little embarrassed.
Yes, I bet she was.
But she was very loyal to him. Anything he said was law.
So that strained relations for a while.
Well, we didn't invite them round to dinner next night.